as the Abbeys ripped apart the man who'd lost his footing on the cliff. Ethan reached the plank walkway. 6 inches wide, it traversed the face of the cliff. Hector was already halfway across. Ethan followed, the forest now 300 feet below. Wayward Pines was somewhere out there, the town still dark but filled with distant screams. On the rock below, Ethan spotted movement. White forms climbing toward him. He shouted to Hector, "They're on the cliff!" Hector looked down. The Abbeys climbed fast, fearless, like the possibility of falling did not exist. Ethan stopped, holding the cable with one hand, while he tried to get a decent grip on the Mossberg. No use. He called out to Hector, "Come here!" Hector turned awkwardly on the narrow planks and headed back toward Ethan. "I need you to hold my belt," Ethan said.
"Why?"
"There's not enough room up here for me to stand and aim."
"I don't understand."
"Hold the cable with one hand. Grab my belt with the other. I'm going to lean out over the edge and take a clean shot." Hector sidestepped the last few feet to Ethan and grabbed hold of his belt.
"I assume it's buckled?" he asked.
"Good one. You got me?"
"I got you."
And still it took 3 seconds for Ethan to steel his nerve. He let go of the cable and slid the strap of the shotgun off his shoulder, aimed the luminous sight down the face of the cliff. 10 Abbeys were making an ascent in a tight cluster. He tried to focus, to put the fear out of his mind, but he kept seeing that man falling toward him, his head cracking open on the rock. The scream, the silence, the scream, the silence. Ethan's stomach turned. The world seemed to rush up at him and fall away at the same time. Get it together. Ethan drew a bead on the leader. The shotgun bucked him back against the cliff, and the report raced across the valley, bounced off the western wall of rock, and returned. The slug hit the lead Abbey. It peeled off with a shrill screech and tumbled down the rock, crashing into 4 more and knocking them down like bowling pins. The others held fast. They had climbed to within 60 feet of the plank. Ethan leaned out once more over the ledge, heard Hector groaning, and imagined the cable biting into Hector's fingers. The remaining Abbeys had taken the hint and spread out. He took his time shooting them down from left to right. No misses. Watched them plunge into the darkness, taking out a handful of others who had just begun to climb. He was out of ammo. "All right," Ethan said. Hector pulled him back onto the plank, and they hurried on, crossing the rock face until they rounded the corner at the end. They rushed up the widening ledge into the mountain. Ethan could hardly see a thing in the passage, and up ahead, the door to the cavern was shut. He pounded the wood.
2 more out here. Open up."
The bolt slid back on the other side, hinges creaking as it opened. Ethan hadn't noticed the door his first time here, but now he made a careful study. It had been constructed of pine logs, stacked horizontally and cemented together with an earth-based mortar. He followed Hector inside. Kate shut the door after him and shot a heavy steel rod back into its housing. Ethan said, "My family."
"They're here. They're safe."
He spotted them over by the stage, flashed an "I love you" sign. Ethan surveyed the cavern, several thousand square feet with kerosene lamps hanging from wires in the low rock ceiling. A scattering of furniture, bar on the left, stage on the right. Both rickety-looking, as if they'd been assembled out of scrap wood. At the large fireplace toward the back, someone was already building a fire. Looked to Ethan like only 100 people or so. Everyone huddled around torches, eyes twinkling in the firelight. He said, "Where are the other groups?" Kate shook her head. "It's only us?" As her eyes welled up, he held her. "We'll find Harold," Ethan said. "I promise you that." The Abbey screams reverberated through the passage beyond the door. "Where's our army?" Ethan asked.
"Right here."
He looked at a half dozen scared shitless people who had no business even holding weapons. The definition of ragtag. Ethan examined the door again. The bolt was a long piece of solid metal, half an inch thick.
It spanned the 5-foot width of the door, which had been expertly cut to fit snugly into the arch. The housing looked durable. Kate said,
"We could all stand right outside the door, shoot anything that tried to come down the passage."
"I don't like it. No telling how many of those things are coming, and no offense." Ethan glanced at the terrified faces surrounding him. "But how many of you can shoot accurately in a pressure situation? These things don't go down easy. Those of you with 357s? You'd better score headshots every time." "No, I think we stay in here. Pray the door holds." Ethan turned and addressed the rest of the group. "I need everybody to move back to the far wall. We're not out of the woods yet. Keep quiet." Everyone began to migrate away from the stage and the bar, groping near the sofas against the rear wall of the cavern. Ethan said to Kate, "We're going to stay right here, in front of this door. Anything that gets through dies. Where's the bag of ammo?" A young man who worked at the dairy said, "I've got it right here." Ethan took it from him and dropped it on the floor. He knelt over it and said, "I need some light, please." Maggie held the torch over his head. He rifled through ammunition, grabbed a box of 2 3/4-inch Winchester slugs for himself, and then handed out backup ammo to everyone else. Moving 20 feet back from the pine log door, Ethan ghost-loaded the Mossberg as an unsettling hush fell upon the cavern. Maggie and another man stood behind the shooters with torches. Kate stood next to Ethan with a shotgun of her own, and he could hear her struggling not to break down. Then suddenly, movement out in the passage. Kate drew in a sharp breath, wiped her eyes. Ethan could feel a fight coming. He glanced back, tried to find his family amid the crowd, but they had withdrawn into the shadows. He had come to terms with the possibility of his own death. There was no coming to terms with seeing an Abby tear into his only son or disembowel his wife. There would be no going forward after that. Whether he lived or not, he would not survive. If the Abbeys got through that door, and there were more than 10 of them, everyone in the cavern would die horribly. He'd expected a scream, but instead came the sound of talons clicking on the stone floor of the passage. Something scraped across the logs on the other side of the door and then began to scratch around the metal handle. 4. Pilcher. The town of Wayward Pines lay in ruin, buildings turned upside down, cars scattered, roads cracked in two. Even the hospital was destroyed, the top 3 floors sheared off. Ethan's house in particular had seen the worst of it. Crushed to pieces, the aspen trees in the backyard snapped in half and shoved through the windows. This architectural miniature of Wayward Pines had been commissioned by David Pilcher in 2010, and he'd spared no expense for the elaborate model, whose price tag came in at $35,000. For 2,000 years it had stood under glass as the centerpiece of his office, a tribute not only to the town itself, but his own boundless ambition. It had taken him 15 seconds to destroy it. Now he sat on a leather sofa, watching the wall of monitors as the real town came apart at the seams. He'd killed power to the entire valley, but the surveillance cameras ran on batteries, and most were night vision enabled. The screens showed what the cameras saw, and the cameras were in every room of every home, in every business, in bushes, hidden in street lamps. They triggered off the microchips embedded in every resident of Wayward Pines, and my, were they popping tonight. Almost every monitor lit up. On one screen, an Abby chasing a woman up a flight of stairs. On another, 3 Abbeys ripping a man apart in the middle of a kitchen. A mob of people running for their lives down the middle of Main Street, overtaken by Abbeys in front of the candy store. An Abby devouring Belinda Moran in her recliner. Families sprinting down hallways. Parents trying to shield their children against a horror they were incapable of stopping. So many frames of suffering, terror, and despair. Pilcher took a drink from a new bottle of scotch, this one from 1925, and tried to think about how to feel about this. There was a precedent, of course.
When God's children rebelled, God laid down a righteous beating. A soft voice, the one he'd long since learned to ignore, whispered through the gale force madness in his head, "Do you really believe you're their God? Does God provide? Check. Does God protect? Check. Does God create? Check. Conclusion? Fucking A." The search for meaning was the cornerstone of human disquiet, and Pilcher had removed that impediment. He'd given the 461 souls in that valley an existence beyond their wildest fantasies, given them life and purpose, shelter and comfort. For no other reason than he had chosen them, they were the most important members of their species since Homo sapiens had begun to walk the savannas of East Africa 200,000 years ago. They had brought his reckoning to bear. They had demanded full knowledge, knowledge they were ill-equipped to stomach, and when faced with the truth from Ethan Burke, they had revolted against their creator. Still, watching their deaths on the monitors wounded him. He had treasured their lives. This project meant nothing without people. But still, fuck them. Let the Abbeys have them all. He had a couple hundred people still in suspension. This wouldn't be the first time he'd started over, and his people in the mountain would support him through it all, unquestioningly, and with pure and total devotion. They were his army of angels. Pilcher stood, unstable on his feet. He moved over to the desk, weaving. No one else in the superstructure knew what was happening in the valley. He'd instructed Ted Upshaw to close surveillance for the night. The reveal of what he'd done would have to be finessed. Pilcher collapsed into his chair, lifted the phone, and dialed up dear old Ted. Pam. She reached the fence in the dead of night. The hole Ethan Burke had dug out of the back of her left thigh radiated pain all through her leg and even up into her torso. The sheriff had cut out her microchip and left her stranded on the wild side of the fence, and up until this moment she'd been obsessed with questioning why. Now, that curiosity was replaced as she stared up at the fence and wondered, what the hell? It was silent. No electricity humming through its veins. Stupid thing to do, but she couldn't resist. Reaching out, she grabbed hold of the thick steel cable. Barbs bit into her palm, but that was it. No jolt. There was something strangely illicit, erotic even, about touching the wire. She let go, invigorated and wet. Limping alongside the fence, she wondered if Burke had done this. A massive swarm of Abbeys had raced past her 2 hours ago. She'd watched them running north toward Wayward Pines from 40 feet up a pine tree. Hundreds and hundreds of them. She quickened her pace, struggling against the burn in the back of her leg. 5 minutes later, she reached it. The gate was open. Locked open. She looked back in the direction of the dark woods through which she and that swarm of Abbeys had come. She stared at the open gate. Was it possible? Had the swarm pushed into the valley? Pam jogged through the gate. It hurt like hell, but she didn't slow down, just grunted through the pain. Several hundred yards later, she heard the screams. Couldn't tell if they were human or Abbey at this distance, only that there were many of them. She stopped running. Her leg was throbbing. She didn't have a weapon. She was injured. And in all likelihood, a swarm of Abbeys had somehow entered the valley. She was torn. The part of her psyche that whispered self-preservation urged her to make a run for the superstructure. Get somewhere safe. Regroup. Let Dr. Miter patch her up. But the part that ruled every fiber of her being was afraid, not of the Abbeys. Not of any horror she might encounter in a town overrun with monsters. She was afraid she would find Ethan Burke already dead, and that was unacceptable. After what he'd done to her, there was nothing in the world she wanted more than to find that man and take him slowly apart. Piece by agonizing piece. Ted Upshaw. The smell of booze hit him as he opened the door to the old man's office. Pilcher sat behind his desk, and when he saw Ted, he smiled a little too wide, his face red, eyes gone glassy.
Come in, come in.
He struggled onto his feet as Ted closed the door after him. Pilcher had wrecked the place. Two of the monitors were smashed, and the architect's miniature of Wayward Pines had capsized, the glass that had once covered the model town shattered across the floor, houses and buildings crushed amid the shards.
"I woke you, didn't I?" Pilcher said.
He hadn't, actually. Ted couldn't have slept tonight if someone had injected him full of tranquilizers. But he said,
"It's fine. Let's sit together, like old friends."
There was a thickness, a deliberation behind Pilcher's words. Ted wondered how drunk he actually was. Pilcher staggered over to the leather couches. As Ted followed him, he saw that the monitors had been turned off in here as well. They sat on the cool leather, facing the dark monitors. Pilcher poured two healthy glasses of scotch from an expensive-looking bottle with the word Macallan on it and handed Ted the glass. They clinked the Crystal Rocks glasses, drank. It was the first alcohol Ted had sipped in more than 2,000 years. When he'd been homeless and drinking himself to death in the wake of his wife's passing, old scotch like this would have been a religious experience. But he'd lost his taste for it.
"I still remember the day we met," Pilcher said. "You were standing in the soup line of that shelter. It was your eyes that called out to me. So much grief in them. You saved my life."
The old man looked over at him.
"Do you still trust me, Ted?"
"Of course," Ted lied.
"Of course.
You shut down the surveillance hub when I told you to."
"That's right."
"You didn't even ask why."
"No."
"Because you trust me."
Pilcher stared into his glass at the swirling amber liquid.
"I did something tonight, Ted."
Ted looked up at the dark screens, felt something go ice cold in the pit of his stomach. He looked over at Pilcher as the man raised a control tablet and typed something on the touchpad. The screens flashed to life. As head of surveillance, Ted had spent a quarter of his life watching these people eat, sleep, laugh, cry, fuck, and sometimes, when a fate was called, die.
"I didn't do this lightly," Pilcher said.
Ted stared at the screens, his eyes locking on one in particular, a woman crouching in the shower of a bathroom, shoulders heaving with sobs as a fist of talons punched through the door. He felt suddenly ill. Pilcher watched him. Ted looked over at his boss. Eyes welling up with tears, he said,
"You have to stop this. It's too late. How is it?
I used our abbeys in captivity to draw a swarm to the fence. Then I opened the gate. Over 500 abbeys have entered the town."
Ted wiped his eyes.
500.
He could barely comprehend such a number. Just 50 abbeys would have been an unqualified disaster. Ted fought to keep his tone in check.
"Think about how hard you worked to gather the people in that valley. Decades. Remember the excitement you felt every time we put a new recruit into suspension. Wayward Pines isn't the streets or the buildings or the suspension units. It's nothing that you built. It's those people, and you're..." "They turned their backs on me." "This is about your goddamn vanity?"
"I have several hundred others in suspension. We'll start again."
"People are dying down there, David. Children."
"Sheriff Burke told them everything."
"You lost your temper," Ted said. "That's understandable. Now send down a team to save whoever they still can."
"It's too late."
"Not while people are alive, it isn't. We can put them all back into suspension. They won't remember. What's done is done. In a day or so, the rebellion in the valley will be finished. But I'm afraid one may be coming to this mountain."
"What are you talking about?"
Pilcher sipped his drink.
You think the sheriff did this all on his own?
Ted squeezed his hand into fists to stop the tremor that was coming.
Burke had help from the inside. From one of my people, Pilcher said.
How do you know?
Because Burke has information he couldn't possibly have gotten without the help of someone in surveillance. Someone in your group, Ted.
Pilcher let the accusation sit. Ice cracked in his glass.
What information are you talking about? Ted asked.
Pilcher ignored the question, held Ted's eyes with his own.
Your group consists of you and four surveillance techs. I know your loyalty is steadfast, but what about your subordinates? Burke had the help of one of them. Any ideas who it might be?
Where is this coming from?
Ted, that is just the wrong answer.
Ted stared down into his lap at his drink. He looked up again. He said,
I don't know who on my team would do such a thing. This is why you shut down surveillance?
You run the most sensitive group in the superstructure, and it's been compromised.
What about Pam?
Pam?
It's possible the sheriff got to her.
Pilcher laughed, derisive.
Pam would set herself on fire if I asked her to.
She's missing, by the way. Her microchip indicates she's in town, but I haven't heard from her in hours.
I will ask you one last time. Which of your men?
Give me the night.
I'm sorry. Give me the night to find out who did this.
Pilcher leaned back and regarded him with an unreadable intensity, and said,
You want to handle this yourself, don't you?
I do.
A matter of honor?
Something like that?
Fair enough.
Ted stood. Pilcher pointed at the monitors. Only you and I know what's happening down in the valley.
For now, it stays that way.
Yes, sir.
It's a hard night for me, Ted. I'm grateful to have a friend like you to lean on.
Ted tried to smile, but he couldn't manage it. Just said,
I'll see you in the morning.
He set his scotch glass down on a table and headed for the door. Ethan. Everyone went silent. So quiet Ethan could hear the fire burning in the hearth at the back of the room. The scratching stopped. He heard the click, click, click of those talons again. Retreating. It made sense. Why would the Abbeys believe their prey had gone behind this door? They didn't even know what a door was. That it was something that opened into another place. Most of them were probably still out on... Something struck the door. The room took in a collective gasp. The bolt rattled in its housing. Ethan straightened. The door took another blow, twice as hard, as if two Abbeys had crashed into it at the same time. He thumbed off the safety and glanced at Hector, Kate, and the others.
How many are out there? Kate asked.
No idea, Ethan whispered. Could be 30. Could be 100.
In the darkness behind them, children were beginning to cry, parents trying to hush them, and the blows to the door kept coming. Ethan walked over to the left side where the hinges attached the door to the frame. One of the rusted brass plates popped a screw. Kate said,
Will it hold?
I don't know.
The next blow came, the hardest yet. The entire top plate detached from the frame. Still four more below it. Ethan called Maggie over and in the torchlight watched the housing for the bolt. With the next collision, it shook but held. Ethan went back to Kate and said, Is there another way out of this room?
No.
The barrage continued, and the more the Abbeys hurled themselves against the logs, the angrier they seemed to get, now shrieking and screaming after every failed attempt. Another plate broke loose. Then another. The end was coming. The thought actually crossed Ethan's mind that he should go find his family now, give them both a quick, merciful death, because once the Abbeys got in, their last moments of sentience would be owned by horror.
The passage outside the door went quiet. No scraping. No footsteps. The cavern held its breath. After a long moment, Ethan approached the door and put his ear to the wood. Nothing. He reached for the bolt. Kate whispered, "No!" But he slid it back as quietly as he could manage and grasped the handle. "Maggie, bring the light." When she was standing behind him, Ethan pulled. The two remaining hinges creaked loudly as they bore the full weight of the door. The firelight brightened the passage. It still smelled of the abbey's rot and death, but it was empty. There were people who just sat against the rock wall and wept. There were those who trembled silently at the horror they had seen. Those who sat expressionless, still as stone, gazing into some private abyss. Others plugged in, helped tend the fire, repair the door, organize the weaponry, bring food and water out of storage, comfort the grieving. Ethan sat with his family on a broken love seat on the outskirts of the fire. The room was warming, and Hector played something beautiful on the piano that seemed to dial back the edge, to make everyone feel just a touch more human. In the low light, Ethan counted their number over and over, kept arriving at 96. This morning, there had been 461 souls in Wayward Pines. He tried to tell himself that it was possible other groups had survived, that they had somehow managed to find refuge, some place where the abbeys couldn't get at them, barricaded themselves in houses or the theater, fled into the woods. But in his heart, he didn't believe it. He might have managed to buy in if he hadn't peeked through that trap door and seen Megan Fisher in the street, and all those others getting slaughtered. No. In the town of Wayward Pines, 80% of humanity had been wiped out. Teresa said, "I keep thinking we're going to hear someone knocking on the door. Do you think there's a chance that some of them will make it up here?" "Always a chance, right?" Ben's head lay in Ethan's lap, the boy asleep. "You okay?" Teresa asked. "I suppose, considering I made a decision that sent most of this town to a violent death." "You didn't turn off the fence and open the gate, Ethan." "No. I just invited it to happen." "Kate and Harold would be dead." "Harold probably is anyway."
"You can't look at it that way."
"I fucked up, baby."
"You gave these people their freedom."
"And I'm sure they really had a chance to savor it as the abbeys were tearing their throats out."
"I know you, Ethan."
"No, look at me."
She turned his chin toward her.
"I know you. I know you only did what you believed was right." "I wish we lived in a world where actions were measured by the intentions behind them. But the truth is, they're measured by their consequences."
"Look, I don't know what's going to happen, but I just need to tell you, I need you to know, that I feel closer to you right now, on the brink of dying, than I have in years, maybe ever. I trust you now, Ethan. I know you love me. I'm starting to see it like I haven't before."
"I do, Teresa.
So much. You are everything."
He kissed her, and she leaned into him, resting her head against the side of his shoulder. He put his arm around her. Soon she was asleep. He looked around. The collective grief was a tangible thing. It seemed to weigh down the air with a thickness like water or dense smoke. His hands grew cold. He dug his right one into the pocket of his parka. His fingers touched the memory shard that contained the footage of David Pilcher murdering his daughter. Grasping it delicately between his thumb and forefinger, an H-bomb of rage blossomed in his gut. Ted had copies of this footage as well, and Ethan had told him not to do anything with it, to stand by. But that was before the Abbey invasion. Did Ted know what was happening in Wayward Pines? Ethan ran another head count. Still 96. Such frailty. He thought of Pilcher, sitting in the warmth and safety of his office, watching on his 216 flat screens as the people he had kidnapped in another lifetime were massacred. Voices roused him. Ethan opened his eyes. Teresa was stirring beside him. The quality of the light hadn't changed, but it felt much later, like he'd been asleep for days. Gently lifting Ben's head off his lap, he stood and rubbed his eyes. People were up and moving around. Near the door, voices were raised. He saw two separate groups, with Kate standing between Hector and another man. Both men were yelling. He walked over, caught Kate's eye. She said, "We have some people who want to go outside." A man named Ian, who owned a shoe repair store on Main called the Cobbler's Shop, said, "My wife is out there. We were separated when the four groups were forming." "And you want to do what, exactly?" Ethan asked. "I want to help her. What do you think?" "So go." "He also wants a gun," Kate said. A woman who worked in the community gardens pushed past several people and glared at Ethan. "My son and husband are out there," Kate said. "You understand my husband is too? So why are we hiding in here instead of rescuing them?" Hector said, "You'd be dead within 10 minutes of leaving this cavern." "That's my choice, pal," Ian said. "You aren't taking a gun." Ethan broke in with, "Hold on just a minute. This is a conversation for everyone." He walked into the middle of the room and said loudly enough for everyone to hear, "Circle up. We need to talk." The crowd slowly converged, bleary-eyed, bedraggled. "I know it's been a hard night," he said. Silence. He sensed anger and blame in the eyes that watched him. Wondered how much of it was truly there, how much he imagined. "I know you're all worried about those who didn't make it in here. I am too. We barely made it out ourselves. And some of you may be wondering why we didn't stop and help. I can tell you right now that if we had, this would be an empty cavern, and we'd all be dead in that valley." "That's hard to hear. As the man responsible for us being in this situation." Emotion reared its head. He let the tears come, let the tremor disrupt his voice. "From my place at the back of the line," he said, "I saw what was happening to our people above ground. I know what these aberrations are capable of. And I think we all need to start coming to terms with a hard, hard truth. There's a chance we're all that's left of Wayward Pines." Someone yelled, "Don't say that!" A man stepped into the circle. He was an officer of the Fate, still dressed in black, still carrying his machete. Ethan had never exchanged words with him, but he knew where he lived, that he worked at the library. He was slim and fit, with a shaved head and faint stubble across his jawline. He also carried that whiff of unearned arrogance that seems to cling to those who crave authority for the sheer sake of power. The officer said, "I tell you what to do. You get on your hands and knees and crawl back to Pilcher and beg the man's forgiveness. Tell him you did this. Tell him you brought this shitstorm down on our heads, all on your very own, and that we want to go back to the way things were, that none of us signed up for this." "It's too late," Ethan said. "You all know the truth. You can't unknow it. There's no easy way out of this." A short, squat man, the town butcher, pushed his way into the circle. He said, "You're telling me my wife and daughters are dead? That at least a dozen dear friends of mine are dead? So, what are you saying we do about it? Hide in here like a bunch of cowards and write them off?" Ethan moved toward him, his jaw tensing. "I am not saying that, Andrew, and I'm not saying we write anybody off."
"Then what? What are we supposed to do?
You pulled the wool away from our eyes.
But for what? To lose most of our people and live like this? I'd rather be enslaved. I'd rather be safe and have my family."
Ethan stopped a foot away from the man. He scanned all the faces, found Teresa's. She was crying. She was sending him love. "I may have fired the opening shot,"
he said. But I didn't turn off the fence, and I didn't open the gate. The man responsible for the deaths of our families, our friends, for you even being in Wayward Pines in the first place, is alive and well 2 miles from where we stand. And my question for you is, are you going to stand for that? Andrew said,
He's backed by his own private army. Those are your words.
Yeah.
So what do you want us to do?
I want you to not lose hope. David Pilcher is a monster, but not everyone in the mountain is. I'm going across the valley.
When?
Right now. And I'd like Kate Ballinger and 2 others who can shoot to come with me.
We should take a large group, the officer said.
Why? So we attract more attention and get more people killed? No, we need to go light and fast. Stay unseen, if at all possible. And yes, it's likely we won't come back, but the alternative is to sit here in this cave and wait for the inevitable. I say we go out swinging.
Hector said, Even if you make it into the mountain, you actually believe you can stop this man?
I do believe that. A woman stepped out of the crowd. She still wore her costume from the night before, a ball gown with a tiara she hadn't thought to take off. Her lipstick, mascara, and eyeliner streaked garishly down her face.
I want to say something, she said. I know a lot of you are angry at this man. At the sheriff. My husband,
she took a moment to collect herself,
was in another group. We'd been married 6 years. It was a forced marriage, but I loved him. He was my best friend, even though we barely talked. It's amazing how well you can come to know a person through eye contact, through subtle glances.
Murmurs of agreement rippled through the crowd. She stared at Ethan.
I want you to know that I would rather Carl be dead, and I would rather die today than live in that sick illusion of a town for 1 more hour. Like prisoners. Like slaves. I know you did what you thought was right. I don't blame you for a thing. Maybe not everyone feels this way, but I know I'm not the only one.
Thank you, Ethan said. Thank you for saying that. He made a slow turn, studying the 95 faces watching him, feeling the true weight of their lives on his shoulders. He said finally, I'm going out that door in 10 minutes. Kate, you in?
Hell yes.
We need 2 others.
I know more of you may want to come, but there could still be another attack on this cavern. We want to leave you well-armed and well-guarded. If you think you can shoot, if you are in exceptional physical condition, and if you can control your fear, then join me over at the door.
Ethan sat on the stage between Teresa and Ben. The boy said,
I don't want you to go back out there, Dad.
I know, buddy. Between you and me, I'm not all that wild about it myself.
So don't go.
Sometimes we have to do things we don't want to.
Why?
Because they're the right things. He couldn't imagine what was going through the boy's mind. All the lies he'd been taught in school suddenly melting against the blistering heat of the truth. Ethan could remember his dad waking him from nightmares when he was Ben's age, telling him it was just a bad dream, that there were no such thing as monsters. But in his son's world, monsters did exist, and they were everywhere. How did you help a boy come to terms with something like that when you could barely face it yourself? The boy wrapped his arms around Ethan and squeezed. You can cry if you want, Ethan said. There's no shame in it.
You're not.
Look again. The boy looked up.
Why are you crying, Dad? Is it because you aren't coming back?
No, it's because I love you. So very much.
Are you coming back?
I'm going to try my best.
What if you don't?
He's coming back, Ben, Teresa said. No,
Let's be straight with him. It's very dangerous what I have to do, son. It's possible I won't make it. If something happens to me, you take care of your mother.
I don't want anything to happen to you.
Ben started to cry again. Ben, look at me.
What?
If something happens to me, you take care of your mother. You'll be the man of the house.
Okay.
Promise me.
I promise.
As Ethan kissed the top of the boy's head, he looked over at Teresa. She was so strong.
You'll come back, she said. And when you do, you'll make everything about this town better.
Hassler. The nomad had planned to spend one last night in the wild, but the moment Hassler zipped into his bivy sack at the top of the pine tree, the realization hit. Sleep would never find him. He'd been out in the wild beyond the fens for 1,308 days. He couldn't be certain, but by his estimate, Wayward Pines was just a few miles to the north, and now that the swarm of abbeys had moved out of his path, he was in the clear to go home. Every harrowing day of his expedition, at some point, his mind had wandered to this moment, wondering, would he ever see it again? What would it feel like to walk back into town, into safety and all the things he loved? There had been only 8 nomads sent out beyond the fence in the history of Wayward Pines. Among Pilcher's inner circle, it was seen as the ultimate honor and sacrifice. To Hassler's knowledge, no nomad had ever returned from a long-term mission. Unless one of them had come back while he was away, Hassler would be the first. He went slowly, methodically, packing his Kelty external frame backpack for the last time, the empty 1-liter water bottles, his flint and steel, an empty first aid kit, the last few scraps of moldy buffalo jerky. Out of habit, he sealed his leather-bound journal in its plastic bag. Everything he'd experienced and encountered in his 3.5 years in the wild was contained in those pages. Days of sadness, joy, days he was sure would be his last. All that he'd discovered, everything seen. His heart, at 160 beats per minute as an abbey swarm, 50,000 strong, had sprinted across what had once been called the Bonneville Salt Flats on the Great Salt Lake. Tears running down his face as he'd watched a life-altering sunset turn the skeletal ruins of the Portland skyline from rust to bronze. Crater Lake, empty. Mount Shasta, decapitated. Standing on the ruins of Fort Point and staring across the bay at all that was left of the Golden Gate Bridge, the top 100 feet of the South Tower poking out of the water like the mast of a sunken ship. All those nights he'd spent wet and cold, hungry and lonely. The gray mornings he hadn't had the will to rise out of his sleeping bag and walk on. The nights he'd sat contentedly before a fire, smoking his pipe. What a strange, amazing life. And now, after all of that, he was going home. Hassler cinched down his pack and clipped in the straps and hoisted it onto his shoulders. He'd pushed himself harder than usual these last few days, and he could feel the strain in his legs and his hips, a slow building ache that would have taken several days of rest to relieve. But what did it matter now? Soon he'd be clean and in a warm, soft bed with a full stomach. No harm in toughing it out on the home stretch. He followed the path of a stream until it branched west. The white noise of the water dwindled away. The woods became dark and silent. Every step held meaning, each one more than the last. A few minutes shy of dawn, he stopped. Straight ahead stood the fence. Something was wrong. It should have been humming with its lethal voltage, but it didn't make a sound. A single thought screamed through his mind, Teresa. Hassler started running for the gate. 5. Ted. Ted's residence on level 4 was twice the size of the others, a perk of being one of the first to join David Pilcher's inner circle. For 14 years, he'd lived in this tiny space, and it exuded the messy comfort of home, with everything, sort of, in its place. Life in the superstructure shook out in a strange rhythm of work and leisure, and it generally took people years to find the balance. Regardless of department, work shifts were onerous. 10-hour days, 6 days a week. And still, things just barely got done for Ted, as head of surveillance. There wasn't a week in recent memory when he had worked fewer than 70 hours. The challenge had come with finding what to do beyond sleeping, with the other 70 hours of free time in the week. He wasn't an extrovert, and even though they existed for him only on surveillance monitors, Ted felt he spent every working second with the residents of Wayward Pines. So in his time off, he wanted nothing more than to be alone. He'd tried painting, photography, a bad spell of knitting, excessive exercise. Until one day, 8 years ago, he'd found an antique typewriter in the Ark, an Underwood Touchmaster 5. He'd carried it back to his residence, along with several boxes of paper, and set up a little writer's desk in the corner of his room. All his life, he'd felt like he harbored within him the great American novel. But now that there was no America, no anything, really, what would he write? Was there even a point to the creation of books and art when humanity lived on the precipice of extinction? He didn't know. But as he began to punch the old keys, worn so smooth the letters were barely visible, he knew he liked writing and that he loved the feel of the Underwood under his fingers. There was no screen. Just the lovely, tactile click-click-click of the keys, the faint smell of ink as the paper scrolled slowly out, and him alone with his thoughts. At first, he'd toyed with a detective novel. That had petered out. Then his own life story, which he quickly tired of recounting. A couple weeks in, it hit him. All day long, he stared at surveillance monitors broadcasting hundreds of private lives in all stages of desperation. He would make the residents of Wayward Pines his subjects, chronicle their lives before, their integrations into the town, imagine their interior thoughts and fears. He'd started writing, and he couldn't stop. The stories had poured out of him, and the paper had accumulated beside his desk like snowfall until he had thousands upon thousands of pages detailing the lives, as he envisioned them, of the people of Wayward Pines. He didn't know what he would do with all these stories, couldn't fathom that anyone would ever want to read them. His working title was The Secret Lives of Wayward Pines. And he imagined the cover as a collection of all the faces of all the people who lived down in that valley. He'd have to finish the book first, and therein lay the other problem. There was no end to the book in sight. The lives carried on. New things happened. People died. New people were introduced into town. How would one publish a living book whose stories never ended? The answer had come, tragically, last night as Ted sat in Pilcher's office, watching on his monitors as a swarm of Abbeys swept through town. The end would come all at once as the God of Town brought a swift and sudden conclusion. The knock came early to Ted's door. He was lying in bed, where he'd been all night, paralyzed with fear, with indecision. He said, "Come in." His old friend, David Pilcher, walked inside. Ted hadn't slept, and by the looks of it, neither had Pilcher. The old man looked tired. Ted could see the immense hangover he carried in the squint of his eyes, and he still stunk of good scotch. A 5 o'clock shadow was fading in on Pilcher's face, as well as sprouting up across his shaven head in fine speckles of gray. Pilcher pulled the chair away from Ted's writing desk, dragged it in front of the bed, and took a seat. He looked at Ted. He said, "What do you have for me?"
"What do I have?"
"Your team. You told me you would handle it. You would find out which of them helped Sheriff Burke orchestrate this rebellion." Ted sighed. He sat up, grabbed his thick glasses off the bedside table, and put them on. He was still wearing his stained, short-sleeved button-down and clip-on tie. Same pants. He hadn't even bothered to take off his shoes. Last night, in Pilcher's office, Ted had been afraid. Now he just felt tired and angry. So very angry. He said,
"When you said the sheriff had information he couldn't have gotten otherwise, did you want to tell me what you meant by that?"
Pilcher leaned back in the chair and crossed his legs. "No, not really. I just want you, as head of the surveillance unit, to do your job." Ted nodded.
"I didn't think you would answer me," Ted said. "But that's okay. I know what that information is. I should have told you last night, but I was too scared."
Pilcher cocked his head.
"I found the footage of what you and Pam did to your daughter."
For a moment, it was painfully quiet in Ted's quarters.
"Because Sheriff Burke asked you to help him," Pilcher said. "I sat here all night, trying to think what to do."
Ted reached into his pocket, pulled out a piece of hardware that resembled a flake of mica.
"You made a copy of the footage?" Pilcher asked. "I did."
Pilcher leveled his gaze on the floor, then back at Ted. He said,
"You know the things I've done for our project. For us to be sitting here right now, 2,000 years in the future, the last of humanity. I saved. There's a line, David." "You think so? You murdered your own daughter. She was helping an underground. There is no scenario where killing Alyssa is okay. How do you not know that?" "I made a choice, Ted, in that previous life, that nothing, nothing was more important than Wayward Pines. Not even your daughter. Not even my sweet Alyssa." "You think,"
tears spilled down his face,
"I wanted that outcome?" "I don't know what you want anymore. You murdered an entire town. Your own daughter. Years ago, your wife. Where does it end? Where's the line?"
"There is no line." Ted ran his fingers over the memory shard in his hand. He said,
"You can still come back from this." "What are you talking about?" "Call everyone together. Come clean. Tell them what you did to Alyssa. Tell them what you did to the people of Wayward. None of them would understand, Ted." "You don't." "This isn't about them understanding. This is about you doing what's right."
"Why would I do that?"
"For your own soul, David." "Let me tell you something. It's the story of my life, people not understanding what I was willing to do to succeed. My wife didn't get it. Alyssa didn't get it. And I'm sad, but not shocked, that you don't either. Look at what I've created. Look at what I've accomplished. If there were history books still being written, I would be listed as the most important human being who ever lived. That isn't delusion. That's just fact. I saved the human race, Ted, because there was nothing I wasn't willing to do to succeed. No one has ever understood that. Well, two people did. But Arnold Pope is dead, and Pam is missing. You know what that means?"
"No."
"It means the dirty work now falls to me."
And suddenly, Pilcher was out of the chair and moving toward the bed, Ted not understanding what was happening until the short blade of the fighting knife in his boss's hand threw a wink of light.
Ethan.
In the end, Maggie and Hector were the only volunteers Ethan felt comfortable with. No one else in the group, not even Kate, had faced down the Abbeys like those two. He figured most courage would wilt in the face of a charging Abbey. Go with known quantities. They armed themselves. Maggie had only shot a .22 rifle once in her life, so Ethan loaded a Mossberg 9.30 with buckshot for her and filled the pockets of her trench coat with extra shells. He showed her how to hold it, how to reload, prepped her for the aggressive recoil. He slug-loaded a Mossberg and then a .357 Smith & Wesson for Hector. Kate chose the Bushmaster AR-15 with a .40-caliber Glock for backup. Standing in the passage, Ethan glanced back at the handful of people he'd armed to guard the cavern door.
"And if you don't come back?" the officer asked.
"You've got provisions here to last a few days," Kate said.
"Then what?"
"I guess you'll have to figure that out for yourselves." Teresa and Ben stood just inside the cavern. They'd already said their goodbyes. Ethan held eye contact with his wife until the heavy log door swung closed and the bolt rattled home. It was freezing. In the distance, daylight streamed past the opening. Ethan said, "Nobody shoots unless we have no choice. Our best-case scenario, we get down into town without firing a shot. Once we broadcast our position, it's probably all over for us." Kate led the way toward the light at the end of the passage. Ethan replaying his last glimpse of Teresa and Ben as the door had shut between them. Thinking, "Was this the last time I'll ever see you? Do you know how much I love you?" They stood at the end of the ledge, looking out across the valley. It was morning. Not a sound rising out of the town 1,000 feet below. The sunlight felt good on Ethan's face. Maggie whispered,
"It just feels like a nice, normal morning, doesn't it?"
They were too far away to see anything distinctly in the streets below. Ethan pictured the pair of binoculars sitting in the bottom drawer of his desk at the station. Would have been nice to have. He stepped to the edge and looked straight down 300 feet of vertical stone that glistened in the sunlight. They worked their way across the plank and rested on the other side at the top of the highest switchback. The stone was warm in the sun. They downclimbed, clutching cables, following the steps that had been cut into the rock. There were no birds out, not even a whisper of wind. Just 4 sets of elevated breathing. Below the tops of the trees, below the reach of the sun, the steel cables were like ice. Then they were off the rock, standing on the soft floor of the forest. Ethan said, "You know the way into town, Kate?"
"I think so. It's weird. I've never been here in the daylight."
She led them into the pines. There were still patches of snow in places, footprints from the night before. They followed the tracks down the mountainside, Ethan scanning the trees, but nothing moved. The woods felt absolutely dead. After a while, he heard the waterfall. They descended a steep pitch of hillside, reached the stream and the opening of the drainage tunnel. The abbeys Ethan had shot last night lay dead in the water and on the bank. There was mist in his face. He stared up at a single cascade that spilled over a ledge 200 feet above. The sunlight made a rainbow where it passed through the falling water.
"Take the tunnel into town?" Kate asked.
"No," Ethan said. "We should leave ourselves plenty of room to run." After a quarter of a mile, the terrain leveled out and they emerged from the woods behind an old, decrepit house on the eastern edge of town, the same house, Ethan realized, where he'd found the mutilated corpse of Agent Evans when he'd first arrived in Wayward Pines. They stopped in the weeds on the side of the house. Up until this moment, Ethan had found comfort in the silence. Now it was disquieting, like the world was holding its breath for something. He said, "I was thinking on the hike down. If we could find a functional car, we could haul ass to the south end of town and not have to worry about an ambush the whole time." "Kate, does that old beater in front of your house run?"
"Haven't cranked it in years. I wouldn't want to chance it."
"The car in front of mine does," Maggie said.
Ethan asked, "When's the last time you took it for a spin?"
"2 weeks ago.
I got a phone call one morning, someone telling me to drive around town for a few hours."
"I've always wondered why they did that," Hector said.
"Because roads are never completely empty in normal towns," Ethan said. just another ploy to make Wayward Pines feel real.
Where's your place, Maggie?
8th Street, between 6th and 7th?
That's only 6 blocks away.
Where are the keys?
Bedside table drawer.
You're sure?
100%.
Ethan peeked around the corner of the house, saw bodies in the distance, and